You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Mike Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today my guest is Jules Pfeiffer, the cartoonist, best known, of course, for the strip that began in the Village Voice in 1956, but more recently, the author of his first children's book, The Man in the Ceiling, published by HarperCollins in the Michael DiCapua imprint. I thought I'd begin by asking if it was fun to do a book where the grown-up Jules Pfeiffer has to imitate a young boy's early fumbling cartoon style.
That was the part that was most scary to me when I began the drawing. The writing came first, and, well, I knew that this was going to come into it. It was the last thing in the world I wanted to do because I was most afraid of failure. And I mean, that the drawing had to be absolutely right. It couldn't be a parody. And the writing of it had to be absolutely right. It could not be fake kids or make fun of it. Or, you know, it had to be right on the money. And I wasn't sure I could do it. And my mother had saved everything. I drew comic books when I was a kid, and my mother had saved quite a bit of them. So I took out my old stuff. I found it in the closet and took it out and just copied and did it over and over and over and over until I felt I could do it without referring to the early stuff, and started to have a wonderful time. But it was a lot of fun, but the fun was preceded by terror.
Are you really still afraid of failure?
I'm always afraid of failure, but what I learned about failure was that, and this is part of one of the things that the book is about, is when there's an area in which I'm really scared to go into, that's where I go right away. It's the first choice. That fear is a healthy direction to move toward.
Now, I wanted to ask you, and I'm curious, I was saying to someone the other day that I thought that the art most congruent to yours is dancing, because the lines that you draw for the human body seem to be more about how that body moves than about what the body looks like. It seems to indicate the intention of movement rather than any particularity of placement. Could you talk about how your figures evolved the way they are?
It's what I've been doing since I was a little boy. In art school, they call it gesture. In theater, it's called behavior. It's how one thing relates to another thing, and it creates the impression of reality, or more important, of truth. You believe it, even though it can't possibly happen that way. And so the dances seem to me to be credible when they are aloft and graceful and elegant, and yet have a reality to them. They're grounded at the same time. And the correctness or incorrectness of the drawing, you know, in terms of anatomically, if you ask me, it's all correct. It's exactly the way the body is made because that's the way the body feels. It's the way the body is supposed to feel from the inside, the way it feels to you when you make these movements. It's what I felt when I was looking at Astaire, who probably was the best art teacher I ever had.
Because I said to my friend, you know, is this an angry sister about to pull a boy downstairs or what? You know, you can feel in the stilled moment the whole sprawl of being pulled angrily against resistance.
You
know, there seems to be so much dynamism, I guess is the word.
And that's exactly what I try for. And I remember this goes back to early childhood when I had a character in a comic book that I was drawing leaping off the back of a truck, and what I was most interested in was trying to create the impression of the road zooming underneath his feet as he's diving off the truck, the way one sees it in movies. Movies were very important particularly the serials, the Saturday afternoon serials, where all sorts of action happened, and I would go home and try to duplicate that action. But nothing ever was still.
This is a sort of what they call among the grown-ups a Bildungsroman. It's the portrait of the cartoonist as a young man. And I think Well, your own mother was a fashion illustrator, yes, and there's a father and an angry older sister who you've talked about before, and a younger sister as well. So this is your book.
I don't think I've talked about my older sister. As a matter of fact, this is the first time I've written about her, and she's dead now, and I'm very, very sorry that she wasn't around to see this book. She would have loved it. She was inordinately irritated that in Grown Ups, the play I wrote about my family, that she was left out because she considered herself by far the most important character in that family and certainly the more important of the two sisters. And I once had to kick her out of my house when I was screening the videotape the PBS presentation because she wouldn't shut up about how lousy this was without her in it.
Grown Ups was a very powerfully dispiriting play, very bleak. And when I was reading this new book, the children's book, The Man in the Ceiling, while it is sort of, what would you say, shrugging about the difficulties of life, it's not overpowered by them. Was this a special dispensation for the young?
Just the opposite. It was a choice. When you write for grown-ups, at least when I write for grown-ups, I think grown-ups should have grown-up conversation about what they're doing and what they're not doing and what they should be doing and what they really like. And in the theater that I loved in my own development was the confrontational theater that made me go home and have a couple of drinks and try to figure out things about my life and what's wrong with it and what's right with it because the play inspired that. I like difficult plays. And I like plays that are difficult to you as a grown-up. But children have a difficult life enough as it is, and they don't have a background of experience for which to work against these difficulties. So what I would rather do in writing for children and what I started out to do is to do something that encourages them more, not to discourage them, not to confront them, but to do what books did for me when I was a kid, which was to open up the world for me, to show me that I wasn't alone, mm-hmm. that I wasn't the only one. I hope that people, when they read about Jimmy and they read about his problems and they read about his dealing with failure, will suddenly come to terms with their own failure, where they use it as a judgment on their own character, when it's not. It's simply a process.
Well, this Jimmy stands by a blackboard wondering why he's being asked these questions rather than the ones that interest him and the ones he knows the answers to about superheroes. He knows he doesn't have a bad memory. He can remember everything about Marvel Comics. And he goes through a terrible torture of really trying to imagine a conversation with his teacher about why he should or shouldn't draw the thing that the most popular guy, the athlete, Charlie Beamer, has asked him to draw, but he can't imagine having a question like that answered. This book had very much the feel of a book of wisdom for kids who are going to ask these questions whether they want to or not, you know, and to let them know that, yes, someone else has asked them too.
Nobody answered my questions as a kid. The answers were generally because... or grow up or stop bothering me. But basically the questions that I had were never answered. And I had to find out the answers myself and only as a young adult, you know, entering into my 20s. But also at a younger age, perhaps, when I started reading fiction. And what fiction did for me as a kid, I was hoping that this fiction would do, because the book is a fiction, that while the characters are all true, although not necessarily real, they're all true, nothing in the book ever happened. I mean, that's all made up. But I wanted to do a book like the books that taught me, to take a kid through fiction, not preaching, not lecturing, not saying this is what you should do, this is what you will learn to do, but through a process. So that the reader, once he's involved with the story, if he or she gets involved with the story, will say at the end of it, oh, I see. Okay, I get it. Wow.
Well, the temptation to parody must have been very great, because when I read about Uncle Lester and his Broadway musical, I think I was anticipating the appearance of John Guerin-like bad songs for Uncle Lester to have written. What was sweet, I guess, about the book is that in this book, people who consider themselves artists are, whether they are cartoonists or writers of musical comedy. In fact, if the book has an axe to grind, it's the axe of being a kid and caring about this stuff and then being cited Picasso as an example of what you want to be rather than the things around you, the things you like.
There was no temptation to parody because every piece of work you start on has its own rules, and the rules are defined by the first page. And if you're moving in a satiric direction, then of course that's what you do, and that's appropriate. This book was always seen as something else. It was seen as a book for kids, about kids, written in a kid's voice, and that was troubling to get. And because in the beginning it was a little arch, it was a little cloying. And the way I learned my way out of that was to go to Tom Sawyer and read what Mark Twain did, which was not give an inch. He just wrote the way he sounded. And that's what I did with Jimmy. I just wrote in a voice that seemed authentic for this kid, for him to be thinking in this way. And since the book is entirely from his point of view, no one else's, parody doesn't enter it because he's not an age for parody. It's his book. It's his voice. It's written in third person, but it's written from his point of view.
I'm talking to Jules Feiffer, who's here in Los Angeles on the occasion of a show of his work, which will be running until November 6th at one of my favorite places in Los Angeles. That's the gallery Every Picture Tells a Story. It's the only gallery I know of that specializes in art for children's books, and the show includes illustrations from Feiffer's new book, The Man in the Ceiling, as well as his illustrations for The Phantom Tollbooth, as well as some of his recent tap dancers and cartoon strips from The Village Voice. How are you feeling on this occasion of, you know, a show?
I've never had this kind of show, and I haven't had a chance to see it yet. I'm very excited about it, and I'm very excited about the book, and this is a kind of moving into new territory for me. And the only thing I can compare it to is when I started close to 40 writing for the theater. Little Murders was written in 1966 when I was 37 years old, I guess, and it changed my life. And I didn't start writing children's books until I was already in my 60s. And it's wonderful to do work the rules of which, the laws of which you don't completely understand, because it starts your process of learning all over again. And I had to learn how to write plays. Now I'm learning how to write these books. And what it does is reinvigorate me, because in terms of the weekly cartoon, which I still do and still love, there's not a hell of a lot left for me to learn. I wish there were, and I wish I stumbled on certain new things that I hadn't done before. But whether good or bad, I'm stuck with what I do. But here I'm not stuck with anything. I'm just learning all over again.
It seems as if in this book, at least early on, an experiment seems to be going on in perspective. The little boy is very little. His father is very big. He imagines himself as Mini-Man. And there seems to be in the illustrations as well a kind of constant play between big and little and what can make something big or small in the imagination. Was that a conscious?
No, it wasn't, but it's interesting you say it, because the thing that dominated my childhood was a sense of continual powerlessness. And I didn't want to be a kid. I wanted to be a grown-up as fast as I could and as soon as I could, so that I could achieve some authority over my life. It didn't occur to me, as it occurs to most kids today, including my daughter, that you have power as a kid. I thought I didn't. And this kid is me, in a way. I mean, he's a lot of other things as well. But he's looking for acceptance. He's looking for some kind of validation. He's looking for some kind of authority. And then he bangs up against the real authorities in the world, whether the authority of his parents, of his big sister, or of the hero of the playground, the great athlete of the school.
There's always been words in your strip, and they've always taken not exactly the foreground, but a big role in what you do. And I've always wondered whether, in evolving funny word, your calligraphy, whether you chose to keep it as spiky and neurotic as it is in terms, you know, it's not Nancy calligraphy. It's not Bushmiller. It doesn't have big letters and clear, you know, it seems to be something that a handwriting analyst would look at and say, yes, that anxious character scrawled in exactly that way.
Again, that's not deliberate. Both the lettering and the drawing style of the strip evolved from October 1956 on, and if you see the early months, and I reproduced some of them some years ago in a book called Pfeiffer's America, the style, everything changed radically within weeks because, the story thrust, the way I told the story, the way I evolved from panel one to panel six or eight was already fairly developed from the beginning and fairly in place. I didn't know how I was going to draw it. I really didn't know how to draw in the style I wanted to. And I was stealing from everybody. I was stealing from William Steig. I was stealing from André François. I was stealing from Walt Kelly. I was stealing from Robert Osborne. I was using all of the people whose work I respected and adored to get me on stage and get me through, because you feel on stage. And I was making a fool of myself on stage because I wasn't there yet. And it took a month or two before I began to sense where I was going with the drawing.
Did you have a special affection for James Thurber?
No. I liked the cartoons more than any, but I always thought there was a smugness in Thurber. I mean, the most irritating thing in my early years was the comparison to Thurber because of the wispy line, obviously. And I did like Thurber's drawings. I thought they were, and in later years I've come to appreciate them even more. But I never really admired Thurber as a writer or as a humorist. I liked E.B. White much better. I thought I liked things Thurber did, like The Greatest Man Alive, I never trusted Thurber. I never believed Thurber any more than I trusted The New Yorker. The New Yorker was never a magazine that represented any reality that I understood. That today there is a nostalgia for the 1950s, if you're in New York, and those were the golden years of the city. Well, I came to maturity in those years. And when people think of them, they think of the New Yorker covers of that time and the New Yorker sensibility and the New Yorker gentility that had nothing to do with any civilization that I occupied. And I felt that I lived in a much more abrasive and far more interesting and chaotic place that the New Yorker would not tolerate. The New Yorker wouldn't tolerate my work back then any more than it would have tolerated my contemporaries at the time, the humor of Nichols and May or Mort Saul or Lenny Bruce. I mean, that there was a battering ram quality to much of what was going on out there that was nearly genteel enough for that magazine. So the New Yorker never represented me.
I had wondered that, too, whether the Second City style, that kind of improvisational comedy style, had been an influence on you.
We were an influence on each other because I started about the same time. I didn't get to Second City, actually, until my second book came out and I was on a trip to Chicago and was taken there for the first time. So, but, you know, something was in the air and there was a kind of humor evolving. And oddly enough, it was not yet evolving in any form of fiction, and the only one doing it in humor was me. It was being done on the floors of nightclub. Nichols and May were doing it when I was doing it. Saul was doing it before anybody. So it was out there, but strangely enough, it wasn't in literature.
Now, it's a funny thing because I expected when I got The Man in the Ceiling, and I received it with great pleasure, that it was going to be a kind of hip book. But instead, it seems to be kindly. Well, I guess it was a book that I felt that if I'd found when
maybe,
I was...
Maybe that's the new hip. or could we post-hip?
a kinder, gentler Pfeiffer, is that? but it did seem to be...
I'm on the kid's side here, and I'm on the family side, and I'm on, you know, I mean, it's a children's book, but by children's book, I mean that it doesn't soften anything. It doesn't lie about anything. It doesn't condescend. It doesn't brush over certain harsh truths. It just has a different attitude and a different ethic. And as I said earlier, There are rules to work. There's a rule to doing a comic strip. There's a rule to doing a screenplay. There's a rule to doing a children's book. And for that to be successful, one of the ways that are absolutely necessary for it to be successful is you follow the rules you set out. You don't screw around with what you've told the reader. And if the reader trusts you from the beginning because you've set out certain boundaries, you have to stay within those boundaries. And this is Jimmy's book, and this is his story. And if I suddenly brought in other aspects of my work, the sharper, harsher, darker, it would have been dishonest. It would have been untrue to the work.
And yet, for instance, I remember when I saw Carnal Knowledge, and if I remember correctly, the opening of that movie is a dialogue that takes place in the dark.
Yes.
You don't see anything. And I thought, well, what a good thing for a movie to do first, not to show you anything, and to have these characters defined in the darkness of their dorm room by what they say, and to, like, deprive the movies of its famous, most visual aspect. And so I guess I thought, well, how is Pfeiffer going to rip apart the rules of children's books?
Well, in Little Murders and Carnal Knowledge and The Man in the Ceiling, there was never any intention of ripping apart anything or doing anything radical or revolutionary. I just said what was on my mind. And in order to get what was on my mind, I told the story the only way I knew how to tell it. Here, too, I tell it the only way I know how to tell it. And in the way it's different, if it is different, it's because I don't know how to tell it any other way. But it separates it from other people's work as well as it separates it from my previous work because I'm telling a different kind of story. I wouldn't tell my daughter the story of Carnal Knowledge and know what I'd And by the way, that opening scene was originally shot in the dormitory. And Nichols, Mike Nichols, who directed, decided that the best way of showing it, that it was boring to watch these guys in the dark, that it was much more interesting to hear them talk back and forth almost in radio dialogue over a black screen with the titles, and it worked beautifully.
I thought so, too. Are you already on to your next children's book?
I finished the first draft.
Uh-huh.
And so far, it's a failure because my daughter, who loved A Man in the Ceiling, I read it to her about a year ago when she was 8, has given up on this book halfway through, so I have to go back to the drawing board. And that she's, I mean, Michael DiCaprio is one editor and Allie Pfeiffer is another one.
It's kind of funny. Is there a champing at the bit? I would imagine that over the years of doing a weekly syndicated strip, that the endless waiting for a play, but even a play has immediate response. The actors are there. But a book, especially for a children's book, this is fairly long. I think it's what they technically call a young adult's book, 180 pages.
I don't think it's young. I think it's somewhere before that. I'm not sure what the – it's also talked about as a crossover, but it's not young adult. It's I don't know, young unmarrieds? I don't know. For whatever reasons, we can go into it, I felt burned out with theater. I got tired of being a pro bono playwright. And also, after my last play, Elliot Loves, which I felt was my best, I thought that at least for a while, I've said all I have to say, or I'm interested in saying for the moment in theater. And yet theater was what I loved to do more than anything else, including cartooning. So I had to find something, some other long form, that would replace that love that I was abandoning, and this is it. And I've had more fun doing this book than anything since writing Elliot Loves. It just has been a joy. And the second book has been a joy, too, and sooner or later my daughter will approve of it. I guarantee it.
What is it called at the moment?
I don't want to get into the second book yet.
I know that... I think I was in fourth grade when The Phantom Tollbooth came out. It was the first...
That's a rotten thing to say.
It's a true thing to say. I was fascinated by it because, you know, it was one of those things at that age. I was fascinated by Lewis Carroll and Alice in Wonderland. So if people traveled to lands where funny things happen to words, that was a book I had to read. And so they gave it to me when it first came out. Was a decision, you know, because this is almost an anti-fantasy book, The Man in the Ceiling. It's a book about how to cope being, wanting to be a cartoonist, having adults around you who say things like, well, how will you support your family and get a real job and look at your uncle, the failure. This is a book about someone who makes a space for himself in the basement, makes a space for himself when asked to go to the store, finally learns how to get Lisi to go to the store. Did you want to do what the anti-fantasy that this seems?
No, I didn't want to do an anti-anything, but also the book is funny. You know, that there is a lot of humor in it, and humor in the very things that you're talking about. I mean, one of the things that really burned my hide years ago when Woody Allen made this idiotic comment to Jack Kroll, not the first of his idiotic comments, as it turns out, or not the last of them, where he wanted to do serious films because comedy doesn't sit at the grown-up table. I've always thought that comedy sits at any table it chooses to sit in, depending on how seriously you take the comedy. And what I've always seen humor in is getting through people's defenses by being funny, by being light, by backing them into perceptions that they might ordinarily not confront in a direct onslaught. If you lecture them, they're going to back off. The resistance will go up. But if you hit them from the rear, from the side, from the bottom, and it's got wit and it's sly and it's true, then it's not just effective. It's funny. It's disarming. And it allows the process to start place that can change things.
I'm talking to Jules Feiffer about his new book, The Man in the Ceiling. Feiffer's work is on show at Every Picture Tells a Story, a gallery, until November 6th. That's at the delightful corner of Sierra Bonita and Beverly Boulevard at 7525 Beverly Boulevard. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, well, that's been a joy.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer today is Scott Fritz. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. The land of ice is flowing books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages, back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's books. Of the mouse, mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.